people make fun of me for wearing camo as much as I do, and I think that some people mistakenly think that I'm doing it to like try and present this persona
Yeah,
of
to set the
like
vibe.
I'm a hunter. I'm such a hunter that I wear camo all
Yeah.
year. It's like, well, one, it's like it's the clothes that I have,
Yeah.
and two, I'm also testing stuff constantly. So if I have a shirt that can stand up to me building barbed wire fence, well, that's a pretty tough shirt.
Yep.
Now I know that when I'm in, going through Devil's Club on the way up a mountain on Kodiak Island, like my shirt's not going to get ripped to pieces.
Exactly.
If I can work in it, if I can work hard in my gear and it stands up, then I know that when I'm hunting, which is just a different kind of work, that my gear is going to stand up still. These are stories of outdoor adventure and expert advice from folks with calloused hands. I'm James Nash, and this is the Six Ranch Podcast. Like ranchers throughout the West, I'm spending the spring building fence, and it is an arduous task. The wire's heavy, the posts are heavy, the ground is rocky. You just break yourself into pieces. So to kind of psych myself up for the day, I pour a cup of coffee into a Stanley mug. I like the titanium series the best. And then I go out and I hammer posts into rocky ground. I stretch the wire. I get cut. I try not to swear too much, and I work all day long. And at the end of the day, I'm going to pour myself a cold drink into one of the coolest products that they make, which is the Lifted Spirits Prismatic Rocks Glass. When you pour your whiskey over rocks into a glass, the ice melts pretty quickly, it seems like. So having that insulation makes for a better drink, in my opinion. And then these things have a prismatic cut in the stainless steel at the bottom that is also really pretty to look at. And I think that that's part of the experience of enjoying an ice glass of whiskey. So there's two times during almost every day that I'm using something from this, great American company that's been around since 1913. They've got all kinds of gear on their website, and you can save yourself some money by using the discount code 6RANCH. That's the number 6 and the word ranch. It gets you 25% off. And then there's a 6RANCH Outfitters collection on their page. There's a link to that in this podcast description. And that will take you right to a page that has all of the things that I like to use. Now, I don't make any money off this. It's not how most discount codes work. This is just a savings that I'm passing along to you. Stanley has been a sponsor of this show for years now. They've been so supportive. And if it weren't for that support, I wouldn't be able to continue doing this. So you can support the show and get a good piece of gear at a discount by using this discount code and buying something that you like or something that you think somebody else would like. So you can go to Stanley1913.com, collections, 6RANCH Outfitters, or you can look at anything else on the website, but use that discount code and save yourself a couple bucks. Well, dude, things are starting to wind down for the spring hunting,
Yeah.
with the exception of a couple states. I think Montana, Idaho still
Yeah.
have some bear hunting going on.
Yeah, Idaho goes till what? I think it's nearly the middle or end of June, or at least a couple weeks in June.
Yeah, it depends on the
unit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because some units start a little earlier, some of them go a little later.
Gosh, they're lucky you have it this year. After that big snow, I mean, nobody's been bear hunting. It was weird seeing
Yeah.
people trying to crush through snow. I mean, it wasn't like a lot of those places where folks bear hunt, you could see and they were losing snow fast. You just couldn't get there.
Right.
That's what all the boys in Montana were saying.
And it only takes one snowdrift.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
And that's often what it comes down to for spring travel. And that's why I have tracks on my side by side.
Yeah.
So if your side by side has tracks on it, then you can go through mud, you can
Right.
go through snow, you can go over rock. But it's the only vehicle that can do that.
Right. And they're expensive too. Like if you're just running
Yeah.
the Tacoma,
Yeah.
you can get through some stuff, but having that track side by side, it's a game changer. However, they ain't cheap.
No, but they do last.
Yeah.
So mine are Camsos, and I bought them in 2015 or 2016. And I've still got them on. They've been on two different side by sides. I just got different drive sprockets for them when I when I upgraded my CCs.
That's right. Yeah, but they're just like such a great tool, but obviously last a lot longer because you're not using them nearly as much as you're, you know, ripping around in the summer and fall.
Yeah, I've got to take them off and put tires on for the summer.
It's always a good metric. I've got a neighbor in town that, you know, we only lived there for a little while, but he's going to be my metric for what the winter's doing. Because he seems like a kind of guy that the tracks come off as soon as they can come off.
Yeah.
So that's like the metric. Like, oh, I can get up that road now.
Yeah.
In the regular Can-Am.
Historically, I go from December 1st until April 1st with the tracks.
It's pretty safe.
But there's still plenty of April that you need them for if you start to go up in elevation.
Totally.
But down in the valley, you don't. Like,
no.
We're not going to get a 2 foot snow in April down here in the valley. It's just,
right. Boy, we were post hauling for turkeys this spring, which is so dumb.
Tell me about that a little bit.
Well, I like hunting turkeys.
Sure you do.
I think it's fun.
Yeah.
I think that they're an incredible animal to hunt because they announce their presence from ridges away. So I had a couple guys out here working on a project, and I told them it's going to be early. But this year, for some reason, I was looking back through some of the notes, and last spring was a sure enough April snowstorm, too. Mm-hmm. We just didn't have the accumulation in some of those areas at that elevation like we had this year.
Right.
It was tricky. If you could get on a bird, so we're post-hauling through, like, you know, thigh-deep snow a lot of places. But it was weird because you could get into certain spots.
Which is armpits for
humans. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. And one of the guys is from Texas, so he's never seen that in his life. We had to explain what post-hauling was, right?
Yeah.
You don't do a lot of that in Tejas.
How even could you explain that? It's like,
I just told him. It was kind of more of a show and tell.
Yeah.
Or show versus tell.
Like, you're going to find out.
Yeah. Yeah, so he was a trooper, though, and we got on this bird through, we probably hiked, like, I don't know, maybe a mile post-hauling, which is probably 10 miles flat ground with no snow, right?
At least.
Like the 10-to-1 rule. And it's also really loud, right? But surprisingly, those turkeys didn't seem to be too concerned about the sound unless you were within, like, 300-400 yards. That's when they're like, that's not an elk, you know?
Yeah.
But if you were, you know, 1,000 yards away, different ridge, you could hear that crunching from there, but they didn't seem to mind. Even like seeing the birds visually, they didn't seem to mind that, but it was tricky getting in close for sure.
Yeah.
So we ended up having to call birds a long ways, which resulted in sort of the elk tactic of backing off 30 yards and another 30 yards. Mm. We got a few birds to do it, and it was cool.
That is cool.
But it's not what you think of when you think of, you know, nice putting your back against a Pondo pine, the sun shining on you, a nice green field.
No ticks?
No ticks.
Yeah.
Yeah, no ticks.
So give and take with everything.
Yeah, I guess.
That's one of the reasons I like hunting bear, you know, right at the crack of dawn of spring bear season is ticks. You know, the diseases they carry are no good.
Oh, yeah. Horrific.
Yeah. Yeah, really terrible stuff. And they just ick me out.
Yeah, it's a gross bug for sure.
Yeah.
And I don't really like spraying chemicals on me.
Right.
Like permethrin and all that stuff. I mean, it's certainly effective, I think.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Of all the things that are going to get you, that's not what I would want to get cancer from or whatever. It's just kind of a gnarly little thing. But again, it's like pick your poison at that point, right?
Sure. Yeah. And the home remedy stuff, you know, you mix up like holy water and vinegar, and it just doesn't work.
No,
man.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
And that's just it. If you're in, like, if you're working in the woods during that time, if you're guiding in the woods, you almost have to have it, I'm sure, because you just can't risk that.
Some of those dudes back east wrap duct tape around their ankles with the sticky side out.
That's smart.
And it's a little tick trap.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they get back in, they'll make, like, little mitts out of the sticky duct tape and,
yeah,
you know, pat yourself down.
Right.
And then, you know, I've seen pictures of guys doing that. And they're picking up, you know, over 100 ticks.
Makes
off
your skin crawl. It's gross.
Yeah.
We were hunting this turkey season, a lot of old clear cuts, a lot of reprod, you know, like probably, I don't know, 10, 15 foot tall trees, barely there. And the problem was you're not crawling, but you're walking through that stuff and you're getting a lot on your head.
Right.
Because you're going under branches that are pretty prone to hold some bugs. But not too horrible this year, though, I wouldn't say.
It was bad here for the last 3 weeks, but I, knock on wood, have not picked one up.
Good.
But out here stumbling around in the brush and fencing and all that, I was getting a lot of ticks.
Yeah.
But what do you think of my fence, buddy?
Good fence.
Looks pretty good.
You did it all yourself, too.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah, the whole rock jack thing is such a, coming from the Midwest, right? Yeah. You drive out and I always think they're deer.
Right.
They got like an elk or deerish look in the twilight. We didn't have those. We had deep, deep soil.
Yeah.
But they're great to see. And it also makes a place feel like your place, I'm sure, a little bit.
Sure. You know, it was interesting because I'd been fighting to not build rock jacks and hammering into rock, literally trying to drive into some really hard rock. And, you know, not all rocks created equal. This is some pretty hard stuff out here.
What is the rock underneath that soil there? Is it like a basalt mix or?
It's interesting here. So there's some basalt from the basalt flows for sure.
Right.
And that stuff I can break.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a layer of white stuff that is alkaline. It's an old seafloor. And Joe Klein and me were talking about it the other day, and he's like, I actually don't know what it is. So he sprayed it with vinegar and it fizzed up.
Oh, nice.
So that's it. It's so alkaline that it has a visible reaction when you spray it with vinegar. And there's some clay on top of that, topsoil above that. But then you get below that seafloor layer and the rock turns blue. And I don't know what it is, but I do know that it is insanely hard. So when, I don't know if you saw it or not, but like when I was building the garage, there was a rock there that I couldn't move, and we would hit it with the excavator and you just blow smoke off of it. I came up and I shot it with my 50 cal. That just blew smoke off of it.
Jeez.
So it's like,
that's your footing now.
So we just poured over the top of it. So now the footing is, you know, we had to cut the concrete forms, which broke Kirk's heart.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, that is pretty incredible. And it's probably going to be there for another millennium.
Yeah.
You know,
so I fought it for a long time. And then I was like, well, I've just got to build two rock jacks right here.
Yep.
And they took me like 10 minutes apiece. Like,
nice.
Such a fraction of the amount of time that it would have taken me to, like, figure out how to drill into that rock.
If you were doing rock jacks only around a perimeter fence, how many would you need per foot? You know,
every 60 feet.
Every 60 feet. And that keeps your shit tight.
Yep. Every 60 feet, it gives it rigidity in every direction. And, you know, you need stays every, I don't know, 10 feet.
Mm-hmm.
More stays is more better, tends to be.
But. And a stay is simply not, it's not going in the ground. It's just hanging on that fence.
Yeah, it keeps the wires the same distance apart.
Got it.
Yep. And I built this last section of fence wildlife friendly, which, you know, we've got a good test going on because I've got a mob of basically cull cows that my little sister's running out here in this pasture next to them. And they're not easy on fences.
Right.
So I've got one strand of smooth wire that doesn't have any barbs on the bottom, and I've got it 16 inches off the ground.
Nice.
And then I've got two more strands above that that are all spread out by about 16 inches. The top two strands are barbed wire. So if a deer jumps over the top of it, it's pretty easy to do because my highest strand is at 40 inches.
Mm.
And deer are good jumpers until 42 inches.
Interesting.
42 inches is when they start experiencing some issues. And they can jump a lot higher, heck of a lot higher, but that's the fence height where you start to see them have problems. And what often kills deer in fence, and I know you've seen this, is they'll go over the top of it, and their back legs will go, you know, under the top wire and catch the next wire down. And when they land, it'll twist and it'll hold them there.
Right.
And, you know, in some cases, they'll die right there. They'll die from, you know, exposure or coyotes or whatever. They're caught. They can't move.
Yep.
It's a terrible thing. So by creating space underneath of it, the smooth wire, for younger animals to be able to pass through without having any issues, keeping the top strand low enough that everybody who's an adult can jump over it, and the middle strand far enough from both of them that I can't create that binding effect, I've got a wildlife-friendly fence. And these cattle have respected it.
Right.
So they have not gone through that fence yet. We'll see what happens when we walk out of the studio.
Yeah.
But I encourage people to look at three-strand fence. It does work pretty well for cattle, and it does work great for wildlife.
Yeah, it's that, I assume, that constant give and take of both and, right? Like you're trying to work the ground for your dollar and the things that make the ranch money.
Yep.
But also keep wildlife around and give them the best chance, even though they are whitetails and you hate whitetails.
We've got muleys here too.
That's true.
Yeah. And it's not that I hate whitetails.
I know the dynamic though.
Yeah. You do.
Yeah.
But I mean it's worth mentioning that the whitetail are not native.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I think that's clear.
And the mule deer are not doing well.
Yeah.
Whitetails seem to be doing fine. So the whitetail don't need my help right now.
They don't. In fact, they probably need a little help on the other side of the equation.
Yeah. Well, I've got three doe points here in the blessed state of Oregon, so hopefully I can draw a doe tag this year.
I've been explaining that phenomenon to some of the folks that I work with in the whitetail world. You know, we're like Wisconsin or Minnesota where you can kill like 8 does.
Yeah.
And they can't handle it.
Do any of those Midwestern states still have an earn a buck thing?
You know, Wisconsin did for a while. I think certain counties, but I think that's kind of gone by the wayside.
Yeah.
Interestingly, in Minnesota, there's like a division line where agriculture stops and deer numbers plummet.
Sure.
Right, obviously. But what's interesting about that break is they're starting, when I was a kid, and we may have talked about this before, but they started planting like red clover in the center median of the highway.
Well, that's a problem.
Yeah, because deer love clover.
Yeah.
Right? So then the number of automobile-related accidents skyrocketed, obviously, because deer are eating in the middle of the night, in the middle of the highway, and people hit them. So that actually did a pretty good number on the doe numbers.
Yeah.
Deer numbers overall, but that's since been a sunsetted program. But, yeah, interesting. I think the funny thing about just the whitetail mule deer dynamic, too, is, like, I think if you took a Midwesterner like myself and put him out here and you see 200-300 deer in a field, that even to a whitetail hunter is like, that seems like too many. Right? So it'd be interesting to get some whitetail guys out here to say like, yeah, this is not going to work very long, because at some point CWD is going to come, right? It's probably already here. Hopefully not, but could be. It's as close as Idaho. I mean,
it's next door.
So that to me is scary, just from a perspective of there's no way to separate these deer out, right? There's no, like, they're going to be in the valley.
Yeah.
So thinking in long term, it's like, man, that could be pretty nasty.
And the way that we're going about CWD, which I really want to applaud Amy Patrick from Oregon Hunters Association for getting after it and trying to create funding for CWD testing.
Yeah, preemptively. Right.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. You know, I really appreciate that. However, that preemptive testing is still a plan that is going to be reactive, right? So there's nothing being done right now, you know, and it's sort of like the early days of COVID. Remember when we were still calling it Corona and like it was only in specific places, like it was in Seattle. It's like, oh my gosh, it's in Seattle. You know, you think it's going to get to Oregon? Yeah.
Yeah. People do move across
it
that
is.
Border. Yeah.
And so do animals, right? So
yeah.
We can't be like, well, you know, it is 40 miles away in Idaho, but maybe it won't make it here. No, it's going to.
Yeah, eventually.
So, yeah, we do have to test for it, but we can also be a little bit proactive with our management.
Absolutely. And that's kind of what I'm talking about, right? Is like looking at the overall herd numbers of a whitetail population. And I'm not a biologist. It's just common to me, common sense. Looking at the overall herd number, understanding that there's a population that indeed wants to help lessen that herd number. Mm-hmm. And maybe not taking 3-4 years to do so for an individual. That's a little absurd to me.
Yeah.
When you can visually see the amount of deer that could be taken off the landscape and it would be a little more healthy.
Yeah.
But that's a tricky dynamic too, I suppose.
And another thing that people have to realize, like when this happens, when we do start getting CWD here, you're going to have to test every single animal.
Right.
So once it's positive, you're going to want to test everything. The states that have it are saying, don't eat those animals. That testing is going to take 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah.
So are you going to have access to a place where you can hang an animal for 3 or 4 weeks, waiting to see whether it's safe to eat it or not?
Right.
And then by the time you get that back, the season's over. They can't reissue a tag.
Yeah. Interestingly, in Wisconsin, and I think they may have done this in Minnesota too, like if you pop a positive test on a buck you've shot, that gives you an additional buck tag for next year. But it still doesn't help the winter freezer situation.
And our buck season's 10 days long.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And you give it a whole nother year. Mm-hmm. Like now CWD has got even a firmer foothold. And what's to say that that next deer you shoot, like, it's a real problem on so many levels, on so many levels. But CWD is not what I wanted to talk about today, sir. Let's get her back on the rails.
Back on the rails.
Summertime. So the bear seasons are over. The turkey seasons are over. We think of wintertime as hunters as the off season. But the reality is the time when people are hunting the least is June, July, and August.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What should hunters be doing in June, July, and August?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot because that changes for me based on what's coming.
Sure.
I think that there's like three sort of categories of preparation that I look at. Mm. And I think the first one's most, it's basically the 3-hour time to invest in whatever you're doing.
Yep.
Your body and your gear. That's the way I see it. So with regard to, time, I think the idea is that most folks, I'm pretty fortunate to work in an industry where we get to hunt a lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I think your opinion matters on this.
Sure. So what I'm talking about with regards to time is thinking about how much time does an individual want to spend in the woods, you know, hunting, doing whatever in the fall time, and thinking about that now. Mm. So that means, for me at least, like in July after I get married, I'm going to buck bales for people. So I'm creating money, right? Additional funds so I can then take the time from my day job to go spend time in the woods.
Let's just say I live in, like, you know, downtown Paris.
Yeah.
What's bucking bales?
You think Paris has a downtown? Probably does. I think the whole thing's probably downtown.
I've never been there. I'm not sure how it works.
Yeah. So
I heard they got attacked by the Vikings a while back.
Yeah. A while back. Essentially what I'm saying is in terms of bucking bales is loading hay for folks, right? Yeah. Basically it's a side hustle.
Yeah.
Is what I'm saying. So what I'm doing is I'm essentially creating time in the future by using it right now. There's long days.
Yep.
By the time I'm done with my day job, it's 4:30, 5 o'clock. That's 4 or 5 hours of daylight left.
Yep.
I just find it the number one thing that I hear all the time from folks is like, if I would have had one more day, if I would have had extended that trip by another week, whatever it is, I could have got it done. Because elk hunting is hard, right?
Yes, it is.
It takes a long time to come from the Midwest to the West to hunt elk and get a lay of the land and execute your strategy and kill an animal and get it out of there. So why not try to create some of that time now in the summertime when days are long? You probably have a little bit more free time in just in terms of the daylight to create some sort of side hustle. And if you live in the middle of a city, maybe it's bussing tables all summer long, you know?
Yeah.
Or whatever it is, right? It's just a little extra cash equaling a little more time in the field. You know, there's a lot of guys that hunt around here that work their ass off in construction from the time the snow melts to the time the snow flies. And that's their window, right? And then they take the fall off. It's a prioritization exercise, I think, a little bit.
Some of the deadliest hunters I know are drywallers.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's not an easy job.
No, it's not. And I think that's part of it, though, too, is like anything's easier than drywalling. Walking up a 2,000-foot pitch to get to a bench is way easier than hanging drywall all day.
Yeah, and you take a guy like Jake Hatley, right? He did my drywall. That's a job that starts out with like just brutally physical work, you know, moving those actual drywall pieces, panels. I don't even know. Moving those things in there is physically demanding. And then you've got to, you know, nail them up. You've got to tape them. And then by the time you're finished, like he's doing artwork.
Yeah.
And it's a really, really beautiful and unique thumbprint that he has on those walls that like everybody looks at it and they're like, wow, this looks really great.
Can't see the mud lines. Pretty good job.
And I see the same thing with heavy equipment operators, right? They start out making the biggest mess you've ever seen in your life. And by the time they leave, it's a park. It's beautiful. Unless I'm the heavy equipment operator, right? I was running a bulldozer this morning before you came over, and I made a mess. And I'll, you know, spend some time this afternoon trying to clean it up.
Getting out of the heavy equipment.
Right. But I'm talking about the guys that are good at their craft. And it's not just the heavy equipment operators and the construction guys, but you'll find a lot of these, you know, calloused hand, blue-collar dudes and gals that, you know, they start with a really physically demanding project and they have to take it all the way to the finest details. And that those skills always translate to hunting.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
Yep.
I think the other essence of this idea of creating time for yourself is always interesting to me simply because there's certain components of the fall that are finite,
right?
Whether it's the season, whether it's, you know, the time you have out there, whether it's the time away from home and other obligations. To me, at least, I think the translation of creating time also is much like you're saying about these folks that know how to do a lot with little. They take into account the timing of the time you have out in the woods, right? They understand how to prioritize certain things, how to create good routes, all these things that, you know, I'm still working on. So yeah, the first one is certainly creating time. I think that is important because we all have busy lives, right? But hunting is a priority for me, and the fall is a sacred amount of time. And I think just getting to around this idea of how do I create more time for myself by working harder now, essentially. The second one is I mentioned the body, like your physical condition.
Yep.
I am not a fan of, you know, the guys that can run marathons and the guys that can lift themselves out of a gym, that's awesome. I don't find that to be effective for me. I'm concerned about really two things, functional movement and cardio. I think that the third component of the body is the brain too. And doing hard things sometimes requires a little bit of mental fortitude.
And there's a very clear science about using your muscles and what that does to improve the capabilities of your brain.
Absolutely.
While it's not always comfortable, and sometimes it's very painful to work out and exercise, it's good for you. It makes you smarter.
Like we were joking about before, I'm not trying to be the best at exercising.
Right.
Like that is not, there's some guys that I'm around that's what they do every day for two sessions a day.
Yep.
The Conor McGregor way, right? Where he's just gym rat.
Yep.
That's not me. I like to do other things too. I like to enjoy myself. I like to eat all kinds of things, whatever. But I think really if you focus on functional movement, such as, for instance, like yesterday I just went on my first like trail run hike of the season. I try to do that 3 days a week. It's not a long ways. It's like 3.5 miles up, 3.5 miles down. And there's a lot of pitches that I ain't running.
Yeah. Right?
Nor should you, because it's hard on you.
Well, you can learn something about efficiency in trail running.
Totally.
Because I used to do a ton of this, and nobody would look at me today and know how much I used to run. But one of the really good lessons that I got from trail running, which I was doing about 130 miles a week, you learn when it's more efficient to walk than it is to run.
Yep.
And you can use that as a metaphor to develop efficiencies in hunting and the rest of your life.
Totally. And I think the component of functional movement as well is like, yes, we haul heavy bags for distance, as my buddy likes to say, but that's a small portion of a week-long hunt.
Right.
Right. I think it's very important that you have the correct muscle structure and body function to be able to do that and not get hurt.
Yep.
But I've seen time and time again, guys that are stacked from the waist up, you know, that have this ability to lift anything, but you put a heavy pack on them and they just collapse.
Yep.
Right. And that to me is not, if the goal is to bring home meat simply, you got to think about it in terms of like, how does your body work in tandem with one half to the other? And how do you get up and down a trail the right way? How do you walk the right way with weight on your back? So really the idea of functional movement is I'm not throwing 50 pounds on my back and going for rucks all the time. I'm trail running. I'm exercising in a way that's functional, swimming a lot in the summer, doing things that make me more long and lean so that I can take that to the backcountry or to the front country for that matter and extend my recovery period. That's the biggest component, I think, of hunting in the West. Because anybody with a lot of gumption can race up that hill and get to the camp spot and be like, ooh, I feel pretty good. It's when you wake up the next day and you're wrecked. That's the biggest thing. And that's where the conditioning and the time in the gym and the time doing things can be really helpful in terms of recovery, for sure.
So there's a couple of gear notes I want to touch on here. And these are lessons that I feel like are solidified by how people walk on the long through hikes, mm-hmm. whether it's the Pacific Crest or Continental Divide Trail, Appalachian Trail. I almost said Appalachian, dude. Will Mahone would have crawled out of the heater and beat me with a, you know, I don't know,
a broom banjo. Handle.
Yeah. Yeah. Appalachian Trail. Every single one of those people has trekking poles, mm-hmm. and they almost all hike in low-topped shoes.
Yeah.
And hunters consistently make this mistake. They don't bring trekking poles, and they have high-topped hunting boots.
Yeah, stiff boots.
Stiff, and, you know, one of the things that comes with that, if you're not wearing them all year long, is they're a bit clumsy, mm-hmm. and they're very loud.
Yep.
So a lot of elk hunting, especially archery season, you do not need, you do not need a stiff boot. You need a quiet shoe. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you want strong ankles because you walked around on them a little bit during the summertime. Not necessarily like, oh, I think that this, you know, 1/8-inch piece of leather going over the top of my ankle is going to save me. Like, it's just not. So have you tried Brad's new trekking poles?
Yeah, I actually have. I ran them all last season. They're awesome. It's essentially like 60% less fatigue, however that's measured, on your knees if you use a trekking pole on each hand coming out. It's incredible.
Yeah.
And we used to call them like hippie sticks and all, you know.
Oh, I had said such bad things about them growing up.
I got this great occurrence. Kaino and I were up in the hills and about to get on this herd of elk. And through this beautiful meadow comes somebody in like a bucket hat with trekking poles just lollygagging through, just blows all the elk out. And they ran as far as you could see, miles.
Yeah.
And we're both looking at each other. So we always call that the, I'm not going to say the place we were, but the hippie stick lady. Yeah. She really ruined the hunt. But all I'm saying is that I look at that a little differently now. Because I'm not old by any means, but I'm certainly not 22 mm-hmm. with full of piss and vinegar.
Yeah.
So I need to be selective about how I treat my body, certainly.
Yeah. One of the things that I appreciated about those ones that Argali's making is the tips on the bottom are rubber all the way around. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the hiking trekking poles, the REI poles, they're pretty loud.
Yeah, totally.
That's not cool.
No, and the trails we walk around on are ridden with rock and stuff, and you're clinking and clacking the whole way up, which isn't really a natural sound in the woods. Like metal on rock is generally human or horse, but
yeah. You can hear it from a long ways.
Yeah, totally.
You can hear it from a long ways.
Yeah, the other thing I like about those poles, too, is the, you know, I've broke a lot of carbon poles. Mm. A lot of them.
Yeah.
Just from using them as a lever to get up off the ground, whatever, and just snap them. And they're dangerous when they snap because they don't just break, they splinter.
Right.
So for a long time, I switched back to like aluminum poles because at least if you bent them, you could bend them back kind of.
Sort of, once.
And one time. I think that's the other thing too is like, you know, the idea of weight too, and we'll get to that with the gear section here in a second, but the idea behind just alleviating where you can. When you're going up and down trails, like why would you not carry trekking poles? It's like the smartest thing ever. And he's sort of built this system where you could use it as a tripod. You can use it as a shooting stick, all these things that coexist. So at that point you're dropping weight from other shit
as
too.
A center pole for your TP.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, always try to find as many uses for something that goes in your pack as possible.
I believe the kids call those life hacks now.
Is that right?
Uh-huh.
No cap.
No cap. It be bussin', I think is what I heard at one point. Yeah.
Dude, language is starting to leave me behind.
I
didn't think it was going to happen this fast.
I feel that too. And I don't really consider myself like a curmudgeon of any kind. I just am not interested in speaking that way. I think so. Maybe that's a curmudgeon. I don't know. But
yeah,
it's interesting that way.
I'm still looking for opportunities to use fire as an adjective, and I'm always too late, you know, the moment's gone.
Yeah, if you got to think about it too hard, it's probably time to not use that word. Oh my goodness. The last one is obviously gear, and I think this gets round and round and round about, you know, cutting toothbrushes in half, and you know, Cody Kellum uses one pair of contacts all elk season like a crazy person and stuff like that.
Does he really?
I think so, yeah. Sleeps in them even. Wild. Huh. You're not supposed to do that for the listeners out there. Like, take them out. They're very light. I think the component I wanted to talk about with gear is just simply using it, right?
In the summer,
yep. Right? That's your time to, like, set up the teepee in the yard. And I know that kind of goes without saying, but it's incredible how often you show up at a camp spot or in a backcountry situation, and it's just not ideal. It's either pissing rain, it's the middle of the night, there's something happening, you know, where you have to be good at doing those things and utilizing them. So
I'll take it a step farther than that.
Yeah.
You need to have all that stuff done by the end of July.
Yeah.
And the reason that I say end of July is because everybody else that is even going to do it is going to do it in the next month or two. Mm-hmm. At the end of July, if you figure out that there's something that's broken in the gear that you already have or something else that you need for a hunt that's coming up, you can actually order it and get it.
Yep.
But if you wait until September, there's a good chance that it's sold out.
Sold out, or you're paying a premium, which is just ridiculous.
Yeah. Surge prices.
Surge prices. That's a real thing, for sure. Yeah, so I think like utilizing your gear in a setting that isn't just at your house too. So like you can combine a scout trip with, you know, bringing a new piece of gear you never used before or setting it up in the dusk, right?
Yeah.
Or doing things that are like hunt relevant, but also just understanding how quickly a knife dulls, right? How your boots lace.
I think sharpening your knives is a great thing to do in the summer.
Totally.
It's good for your mental health. It's a skill that we're starting to lose.
Totally.
And it's just a great thing to do. So if you can't get out, if the weather's trashy or, you know, whatever the situation is, like just sit down and make sure all your hunting knives are sharp.
Right.
Like really, really sharp and a good sturdy edge. There's no burr that's left on there that just makes it feel like it's sharp. You know, sharpen all of your knives.
Right.
It's good for you.
Totally. I think the other thing too is like when it comes to hunting clothing, which is the world in which I work, and we're always, you know, testing things that aren't on the market yet. So I guess my situation is a little different, but one of the folks we used to work with would just wear his gear for days.
Yeah.
Just to see how it felt.
Yeah.
So that you expect that when you get to day four and your merino wool is a certain way and your socks feel a certain way, it's not a thing you're thinking about. You're used to it, right? Yeah. So you're basically like combining this idea of treating your body well with also your gear to understand that, you know, socks are going to get crusty probably. Yeah. That's okay. doesn't mean they're broken, doesn't mean you're gross, just means that's the way it is. Just like eliminating all the stacks of things in your brain when you're simply trying to arrow an elk, which is a really hard thing to do normally.
Mm-hmm.
I just getting familiar with your stuff.
I do it too, and I know you do it, but and people make fun of me for wearing camo as much as I do, and I think that some people mistakenly think that I'm doing it to like try and present this persona of
to
like
set the vibe.
Like I'm a hunter. I'm such a hunter that I wear camo all year. It's like, well, one, it's like it's the clothes that I have.
Yeah,
and two, I'm also testing stuff constantly.
Mm-hmm.
So if I have a shirt that can stand up to me building barbed wire fence, well, that's a pretty tough shirt.
Yep.
Now I know that when I'm in, you know, going through Devil's Club on the way up a mountain on Kodiak Island, like my shirt's not going to get ripped to pieces.
Exactly.
If I can work in it, if I can work hard in my gear and it stands up, then I know that when I'm hunting, which is just a different kind of work, that my gear is going to stand up still. So finding those failures, you know, when the consequences aren't high is really, really important.
Yeah, absolutely.
What about research?
Yeah. And I think that I'm trying to keep this under four things. We always talk about like you can do four things well, right? So I think if I was to consider another category for summer prep, I think research in a nutshell is a great one because you have to have some sort of basic playbook to approach this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And let's call it like an elk hunt for this example, right?
Sure.
I think so much is overblown on, and obviously personal opinion, but I think there's a lot of fodder and a lot of talk around diving into the research versus spending time in the summer to gain a little bit of extra cash to spend two more days in that country.
Yeah.
I think true perspective is only gained through on the ground experience, at least for my sake. I can pore over 3D maps and look at, you know, harvest information and water sources. That's all good to do. You should do it. But the time in the field, I think, is especially for somebody who's doing it for the first time or whatever. I think that's the key component of my research is getting to this place I want to go a little early.
Yeah, man, I've got some beef with some of the e-scouting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And what I would like for people to consider, and there's a lot of people that beat the e-scouting drum. Some of them go out and kill stuff every year,
yeah.
And some of them don't ever.
Yeah.
So look at the application of the person that's actually teaching you this stuff. And if you just enjoy e-scouting for the sake of e-scouting, which a lot of people do.
Totally.
Like Jaden, I think probably likes, you know, that front end research as much as he does the hunt.
And I can understand the connection point when you make it in the field.
Yeah.
When you put in the time and you're like, I know there's a water source here. You've got your lay of the land.
Mm-hmm.
For some folks that works really well. For me, I'm much more visual in terms of like authentic visual.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm a better predator when I'm on the landscape than sitting behind a computer.
So flying is a really good example. Mm-hmm. If you actually go out and scout from an airplane sometime, you will come over the top of a ridge that you know, and then you'll look across and, you know, see a herd of elk and be like, oh man, I know how to get here, and then I can just walk right there.
Yeah, kind of. In like 4 days, right?
Right.
Yeah, totally.
And it looks like, oh, I could be there in an hour, and I know how to get right here. And then you walk back out there and you look across and you're like, it's gonna take me all day or a couple days.
Yep.
So that's a firsthand visual experience. Now back that out even farther, and now you're doing it from a satellite on a flat screen on a computer. Mm-hmm. There's some ground truthing that's really difficult. Yesterday was Memorial Day, and I did something that I just fight myself almost daily not to do, which is to use Google Earth to go back over all the battlefields that I was on.
Yeah.
And man, I was remembering how difficult it was because we would scout and plan missions with Google Earth. That was a tool that we had. You cannot tell the difference between a wall and a ditch on Google Earth, because that satellite's looking straight down, baby.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really, really hard. So there would be so many things that we would run up against that would be like, well, that's not supposed to be there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's so true.
Who changed this? No, so
I think
funny.
A good example, too, of that, James, is just looking back to turkey season where, you know, the landscape where we turkey hunt changes often because it's timber ground and they're always harvesting trees and planting trees and changing the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
You can sort of see that on real-time Google Earth a little bit. You know, it's like, oh, this is light, this is dark. But I got out there early in May and went to a spot I know and was like, the pin says I'm here, but I'm not here, because they had just nuked the whole thing, right? So there used to be a beautiful roost ridge, all this stuff going on. But I guess that just plays into the point of, like, you got to go look at it.
Yeah.
You got to have your feet on the ground. You have to understand how long it's going to take you to get places. And e-scouting is a wonderful tool. I find myself doing that roughly.
Yeah.
I would say.
Yeah.
Like, this is what the landscape might look like. These are some key points I want to try to get to, and that's where I leave it.
Yeah. For elk, I have three criteria that I look for e-scouting, and I'm not going to say them because I don't want people to know what I evaluate stuff off of, but they're very basic. And as soon as I add those three criteria to a very new place, then I find the center of what just met that criteria. I drop a pin in it. We did a hunt in Colorado a few years ago that I'd never hunted in Colorado before. I dropped five pins on the map and we killed two bulls within 200 yards of two different pins.
Yeah, that's good science.
Yeah. And you can start to do that, but do it in reverse. So if you've been hunting for a while and you've had some success, look at where you were successful and then try to develop criteria around, you know, what made that spot during that time effective. And then you can start finding new places that will fit the bill. But what about, man, I used to really preach talking to biologists.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm going to do that anymore.
You think you're just getting, like, they're giving the same line, so to speak, or is it just not as helpful?
If they'll even talk to you.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, again, I think I'm fortunate to hunt some private ground in the Midwest where that's not as relevant, potentially, or they got a really good relationship with the biologist, so the information is very valid. Quite honestly, I don't really like talking to anybody, because you're always going to get that bias, or somebody's going to try to steer you in the wrong direction, or the right one might not work for your style, whatever. What's your theory on not talking to a biologist now?
Well, you know, a lot of them just won't answer the phone.
Yeah.
Or won't call back. And if they do, they feel really limited in what they're able to tell you. You know, they act like the information that they have is top secret.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not. Like, they're a public agency.
Yeah.
But it just hasn't been helpful for me. And I really try hard to develop those relationships. And, you know, I want to share the science and the data that I'm collecting with state biologists and hope that they'll do the same with me. And it hasn't been working out. Trying to get a biologist on the show is almost impossible.
Right.
Almost impossible.
Just because of all the red tape, probably.
Yeah. You know, they want you to talk to a PR person from the agency that doesn't know anything about biology.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that's, I don't need a human resources edition of what's going on with, you know, whether cow elk are trending towards an older age class in Eastern Oregon.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. That's an interesting conundrum a little bit too, because I think at some point there was this, that was the form of information if you're going to a new place, right? Mm-hmm. You stopped at the district office and got the intel. And I feel as though it's the same way of like a bait shop guy in the Midwest, where it's like, this is what they're hitting on.
Yeah.
And it's just like the same for everybody. So maybe it doesn't give you an advantage. It might give you a good starting point.
Yeah. You know, with a bait shop guy or like the fly shop guy,
yeah,
I do I do still give them quite a bit of credibility.
Yeah.
Because they're invested in you being successful.
Totally. So you come back.
So you come back and buy some more stuff.
Fly shops especially, because the majority of people are letting those fish go.
Yeah.
Generally.
Yeah. Which is interesting, right?
Not so much in the Midwest, where you're bonking limits and filling freezers on the walleye.
I've really gone back and forth on catch and release. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, so many of the fish that we release die.
Yeah. Like, I mean, the mortality rate after a 20-minute battle in a river is can't be good.
And it's a known percentage. It feels unacceptable to me.
Mm-hmm.
To be releasing a fish that dies, even though, like, if it dies, it's just going to do a lot of good out there in the river as a dead fish.
Yeah.
So I don't consider it a waste because I didn't eat it.
Yep.
You know, it's probably going to do, you know, serve a much greater good by decomposing in its own ecosystem than it would, you know, me eating it. But gosh, I don't like the thought of a bunch of fish getting caught for recreational purposes and then released and killed.
Yeah.
So there's things that we can do to decrease that. Like use heavier gear, fight fish harder, use barbless hooks.
Yeah.
Keep the fish in the water. Don't touch it with dry hands. Like there's some basic stuff, but
Yeah. And that's just an information set that someone needs to understand probably.
Yeah. I really don't like releasing bass.
Oh, it's the worst.
Yeah. They should just get eaten.
It's so funny. Nobody eats them in the Midwest.
Yeah.
It's a total catch and release.
It's like sacrilege. Right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, because there's other species that are better to eat, you know.
Like walleyes.
Walters, buddy.
Yeah. Walleyes and perches.
Yeah, that's right. And the sunfish category. That's a good one.
Yeah. Are you ready to fillet some more crappie?
Yeah.
Okay.
That was quite the endeavor we went on.
How many fish did we end up catching that day? Was it 500?
I think it was more than that. I 600? Thought we had a clicker going at one point, but it was fun until it wasn't.
Yeah.
I think we were cleaning the fish as we were going, too, weren't we?
So after 200, we started rotating. So two guys were filleting, and I think we had four guys fishing.
It's a commercial operation at that point.
Yeah, and then once we got to, I think, 300 fish, we just went to catch and release for the...
So the boys could rest the hands.
Yeah. But, you know, some of those fish, those warm water fish, they have such higher survivability on catch and release than trout do. Trout just don't do well, especially in warm water conditions.
Oof.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why you get the, what's it called? The hoot owl closure?
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Which is good.
Which is a good thing. Yeah. I support it.
Real good.
Yep. Full support of that. And that is like... That's hard science. Like, hey, we put a temp logger in the river, and at this time of day, if Kyle Bratcher says if at this time of day the water temps are too high for fish to have a reasonable chance of surviving after they get caught, so we're not going to allow fishing in these sections of the river after this time of day, like, full support.
Yeah.
100%. I love that. That's my favorite kind of science. And as soon as the temp logger says something different, they're going to change it.
Yep.
Like, I really, really like that. Kyle does a great job. He actually puts out a newsletter. I don't know if you're on this or not. I should get him to add you to it. So every month or two, and I'm talking about our district fish biologist here, he goes through, like, what's predicted with the salmon runs, what's predicted with the steelhead runs, what, depending on the time of year, how many fish have passed the dams, what the outlook is. He's got links and graphs, and he's taking everything that he's dealing with in science and then sending it out to anybody who's interested. I love that.
Yeah, it's great. It's an advantage too as a sports person to just understand the dynamic situations of fish runs or whatever it is.
Yeah. Right?
That'd be great to have on the hunting side, wouldn't it?
Gosh, wouldn't it?
That'd be pretty nice. And those things sort of exist, but it's mostly just like, did we hit our objective for animals killed in a unit? Here's the data.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's tricky. Any things that hunters should not be doing in the summertime?
Drinking.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, like, as I get older, that is the number one killer of all things mental, body, gear prep, whatever. So I take a pretty big break from middle of July all the way through, at least through the end of September.
I also, in, I think, listeners know that I'm a fan of a nice glass of whiskey.
Yeah.
I don't drink during hunting season.
I think especially in a client situation too, right? Or yeah, guiding guys.
You definitely can't.
You just have to be sharp and you can't. And I think just too, like as you get older, there's so much data that comes out about what alcohol does to the body, right? And again, moderation in all things, including moderation once in a while. But I would say once that, you know, 4th of July window starts creeping up, your brain should focus to like, how can I be sleeping well, eating well, getting ready for this thing we hold so dear? You know, we only get to do it like really, the average person probably gets to hunt, what, a week a year, 2 weeks full maybe?
Yeah. And how many years do we have?
Yeah, exactly.
We don't know.
We don't know.
Could be the last time. Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that cell phones and light beers save a lot of animals.
Absolutely, man.
Yeah.
They save a lot of turkeys. I was just shocked at how many people were, you know, hanging up the shotgun at 9 a.m. I'm like, boys, it's going to get really good right now. And it's just it's a good reminder that there's a nice part about having a paper map and no booze and just warm water.
Yeah.
Can kind of set a guy straight.
You know, I'm thinking back over this conversation a little bit. One physical skill, and it might be a mental skill, something that is a pitfall of guys that get really good at cardio is they end up leaning on that and they move around too much.
Absolutely, and I'm guilty of that 100%.
So finding ways to practice patience is going to be really important and really helpful.
Yeah. Should remodel a house every spring. That'll give you a lot of patience.
Yes, it will.
Yeah.
And a fair bit of cardio.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That happened to us last fall. Celia and I were on a hunt in Idaho and hiked a lot. It was hot. The first, the opening week of buck season over there was like 80s, right? Abnormal. Year before we had 15, 17 inches of snow. And we probably hiked in 7 or 8 days, 100 plus miles, right? Ended up killing Celia's buck 40 paces from where we started, right? So that is the case. We knew that the deer were not going to be on their feet all day. It was a morning and evening game. We should have just hunkered and waited because I knew there was deer there. But I was trying to square peg a round hole, right?
Yeah.
So I agree with that. It's good to figure out a way to be patient. And that could come in any form of practice, right?
Yeah, and something we get spoiled on down here in the States that the Alaskans don't get the benefit of is we can hunt most days. We rarely get weathered out.
Yep.
And when you're talking about building extra days into a hunt, whether that's because you made more money having a side hustle in the summer, or you know you invested into your relationships a little bit more in the summer, so now like you've bought some social stock and being able to stay away an extra couple of days, whatever you did to provide yourself that extra time, it might not go towards like scouting the first 2 days of the season or 2 days before the season. It might go towards like, hey, we had two bad weather days, so let's just hang out in the tent and play cribbage. And when it clears up, we'll go again.
Yep.
In Alaska, you should probably plan, depending on where you're going and when, but you should probably plan for 70% of your days to not be able to hunt.
Yeah.
And if it's better than that, high fives, like, great.
Yeah.
But you know, you can't go up there on a week-long hunt and expect to be able to actually have a day to go out. Like, you need a 10-day hunt, and you need to hope that on three of those days you can make it. And then you need another 4 days built into the back end in case the plane can't come get you out of there.
Right.
Because that weather can roll back in again. So that's another brand of patience that we should all work on a little bit harder down here. In the old lower 48.
Amen.
It's like how to manage weather days and how to keep your mind right and ready to go for when it does break.
Yeah, an hour in the tent in a bad weather day is like 6 in normal life, dude. I think.
Yeah, when it's, you're just getting, you know, wet nylon beating against your face. And,
exactly.
Yeah.
It's brutal. It's not good for a guy's brain, but at the same time, if you've prepared and can kind of get through that, that's pretty remarkable.
Yeah. So you know, grab your dark energy charger so you can play an extra game or two on your phone. Yeah, I don't know. I think that's another brand of patience that is pretty helpful. It's like, not just, can I hang out here and glass for an extra hour, even though I'm not seeing anything? It's like, can I spend 2 days here, three days here, and never have the opportunity to get out of my tent?
Yeah, that's rugged times. You learn a lot about yourself and your brain at that point, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How would you practice that? How would you prepare for that?
Man, that's a tough one, because I don't think there's anything in the world that you can't get out of, you know, that's like that. Like, if you're in Alaska on a ridge and you're getting ripped by rain and snow and whatever else, there is no alternative at that moment, unless you pack it all up and stumble your way out of there. But then you're just sitting at a landing strip.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if there's anything quite like that in our day to day. Maybe like a middle school track meet or something.
Yeah.
Like, that you have to be at. I don't know.
Yeah. I think just maybe like delayed gratification of something.
Sure.
Like, take something you want and, you know, make it available, but don't touch it for a day.
There you go.
You know, find a way to strengthen your mind and your resolve.
Yep.
That way might help. I don't know, maybe a cookie. Set a cookie out on the counter and be like, tomorrow, son.
Oof, boy. I don't know if I'd last that long.
Walk past it.
Sully makes good 19 cookies.
Times. Yeah, she does.
Yeah. Really good cookies.
Good reminder.
Oh, yeah, I need my cookie tray back. Oh, grave mistakes.
Yep. Okay, well, I think this is a good start. How can we summarize this in a couple sentences?
Yeah, I think so. For summer prep work, you know, if we create the fall to be this pedestal time, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's three things I would look at, maybe four. Take care of your body, get it prepped for the arduous days that you might have and the things that need to occur to be successful. Know your gear.
Mm-hmm.
Do your research, I think, was the fourth. And I forget the third one already. What was the third one? Oh, and make time.
Yeah.
Make the time. Make a little extra cash.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's pretty solid. That's a good plan.
I mean, it goes a long way. I think a week of buck and bales, or a week of, you know, whatever it is, even if it's $500, right?
Yeah.
Or if it's just that you got to work harder at the office to gain in week in September.
Yeah. Go do construction cleanup.
Or whatever.
Yeah. Find something that gets your body moving. And that kind of labor is very functional fitness.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah, I like that.
Yep.
The best fitness advice I ever heard in my life, which I've heard a lot of good and a lot of bad, when I was getting, I was probably 2 years out from going into the Marines at this point, but I was already preparing. I asked a guy who'd been in and gotten out what his advice was for fitness. And I was expecting to hear like bench press goals and, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah. Like the sit-up push-up test.
Quantifiable stuff. And he said, get your feet hard and be good with your own body weight. Mm. Well, that's
pretty
incredibly
standard.
Good advice.
Yeah. Keep it simple.
Yep.
I like that a lot.
Yeah. All right, my brother. Thanks. You so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Let's go get that cookie sheet. Thank you all very much for listening. I'm going to keep bringing you these stories from normal people just like you who have done extraordinary things. Everyone is an expert at something, and they have interesting perspectives on life and work and the environment and all of the things that we care about. I'm going to keep bringing that to you. And I want to thank you so much for making this show possible. I also want to thank Emily Bratcher for producing this show. She does a great job editing. Really appreciate her. I want to thank John Chatelain. He did the art for the Six Ranch podcast. And Celia, soon to be Harlander, she digitized that so that we can get it out there on the internet for you. Also want to thank Justin Hay for writing this original music and the beautiful whistling that you're listening to right now. You guys are awesome. thank you so much. Please keep listening to the show. Write me a review if you feel like it. And just keep doing your thing, and we'll all learn from this together. It's been fun, and you know, we're just getting started.